from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. If you have a white-collar job, it's likely that you work in an open office, the kind without cubicles or private office spaces. In fact, 70% of U.S. offices have open floor plans. The idea was that wall-free spaces would foster better communication and innovation. Silicon Valley loves the open office, with Facebook claiming the world's largest open plan office at its Menlo Park campus. But many workers complain, saying the layout is too distracting, noisy, and lacks privacy. Coming up on Forum, we talk about the future of workplace design, and we want to hear from you, and that's coming up next, after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Approximately 70% of United States offices use open workspaces without offices, according to a 2017 Gallup poll. Experts say these types of work environments increase collaboration and innovation. But when Apple presented its employees with a more open floor plan at its new campus, some workers threatened to quit. Many workers say open offices are distracting, noisy, and lack privacy, like in this scene from The Office.
What are you doing?
Just clearing my desk. I can't concentrate.
It's not on your desk.
It's overlapping. It's all spilling over the edge. One word, two syllables. Demarcation.
We're going to discuss open work environments and why they're so popular with companies and unpopular with workers, and we'll hear about the history and future of the workplace. Joining us here in studio is Elaine Moore. She's deputy editor of the Lex column at the Financial Times. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Good to have you. Good also to have Janet Pogue McLaurin, and she's global workplace leader with Gensler. Welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Glad to be here.
And we want to welcome also Nikhil Saval, who is editor of NN1 magazine, author of Cube, The Secret History of the Workplace. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And let's begin with Elaine Moore, who is here with us in studio. And begin by talking about, let me just say something about the history. This all began in Germany, and it was all kind of motivated by egalitarian ideals to avoid hierarchy. Largely failed, but here in the United States, it's become increasingly popular, and it failed there for the labor unions for the most part, but a success here mainly because of cost-cutting.
There's a really good reason that it's so popular, and that's because it's much cheaper to put all of your workers into one space and not divide that space up with private offices or even with cubicles. The idea in a perfect world is that it's supposed to foster collaboration. And so everyone talks to one another and we do more work together and things get better faster. But what tends to happen, and I work in an open plan office as well, is that people are not very fond of having conversations in public in front of a large audience. So they tend to send emails. There was a Harvard study that found that people talked less in an open plan office than they did in private offices. People tend to wear headphones. I wear headphones myself if I need to concentrate. I think this makes me sound a bit misanthropic, but I'm not. I like my colleagues and I like working in an open plan office in order to talk to people. But when you need to concentrate, it's incredibly difficult.
Well, but they are cheaper and they tend to divide between, well, open spaces of, it's a whole spectrum of open spaces, but difference between what you find in the tech world and what you find, say, in the legal profession.
That's true. That was why I wrote about this for the Financial Times, because I was just so interested in coming out to San Francisco and the Bay Area to see whether the tech industry had come up with some sort of innovative new way of putting its workers into offices. And I've been to a few headquarters, and what I found is they look remarkably similar to every other office that I've ever worked in, perhaps just with better lighting and nicer desks. But everybody is still crammed into the same sort of spaces. You're still trying not to catch the cold of the person next to you. You're still having to try and block out the noise of the person on the phone and the opposite side of the room. So I agree that they are slightly different in different workplaces, but everywhere I've ever worked has always looked pretty much the same.
One of the things that's different, one of the biggest workspaces and perhaps most notable over in Menlo Park, of course, is Facebook. And I said this was supposed to work against hierarchy, but you have Mark Zuckerberg right in the middle of things in Facebook. But most places, there's a separate place for the person in charge.
Yeah, you can see a video of Mark Zuckerberg at his office. He put one out in 2015 when they moved in. It's really interesting. His desk has practically nothing on it. There's nothing you can really see. But the fact that he's surrounded by his colleagues is really interesting, because I think one of the ways that you can see how a company's executives might feel about open plan offices is that they very rarely put themselves into open plan offices. Bosses tend to keep their own offices and they let the workers share desks.
And there's also a kind of new buzzword, mixed use space, bringing the outdoors and that sort of thing.
This is fascinating. So WeWork, this is the new cool face of office work, and the idea is we're going to be working in WeWork, hot desking and moving around between cities and countries as much as we like. It's got a near $50 billion valuation on this idea of intense collaboration, pushing more people into smaller spaces, offering them a sort of very hip, cool office to work in. But I've visited quite a lot of these and they are beautiful spaces and I would happily work in one. But what I found was that the areas that where people were meant to be sitting in mixed use, you know, all sitting on the same desk, those were quite empty. The places with private spaces where you could sit by yourself on a tiny desk, they were all full.
Lane Moore here with us in studio, deputy editor of the Lex column with the Financial Times. And Janet Pogue-McLaurin is global workplace leader with Gensler. And Janet, could you talk a little bit about, defining what we mean by an open workspace? There's, as I said, a whole spectrum here, isn't there?
It really is. Open office has actually been around for a really long time, even in the U.S. It started from rows of freestanding desks in the earliest office buildings to the paneled workstations that were characterized in Dilbert to benching or even shared big tables that we're often seeing in some of the companies today. And so I agree with Elaine that open plan was often hyped to increase team building and collaboration following what often the tech companies did in that whole industry. But we know that not all industries work the same way.
As I said, there's certainly a pretty conspicuous division between the legal industry and the tech industry in this vein. But you get the same kind of complaints from both with open offices. And that's what I'm interested in keying in on with you, the lack of privacy, the inability to focus, and the noisiness, even though they become more and more popular.
They are, and they're even becoming popular in the legal industry, believe it or not. And but as architects and designers, we know there's a wide range of open and enclosed environments. And when we have discussions in the media and various studies, even like the Harvard study of open versus enclosed, it's creating a myth that all open offices don't work. And we know it's more complex and nuanced than that. Gensler has been researching workplace for over a decade, and we've done three separate independent surveys in the U.S., and we've done them globally as well. And what we're discovering is one size does not fit all. And in order to create a great workplace performance, it must prioritize both effectiveness, which is like the ability to focus and the ability to collaborate with others for group work, but also to provide a great experience, which is those social spaces and communicating purpose and meaning and in order to be successful. And so it's that mix and balance of those spaces that really create a great open plan that also has enclosed spaces as a mix.
Well, we should make it clear that your firm builds these office spaces, and there's still a trend. I mean, the trend is still very much with us. And the research also says that maybe the most important thing, from what I'm reading, is the place should be identified as, well, a place that enhances one's work and makes one pleased to be there and connect one's identity with that space.
That's right. I mean, we sometimes lose fact that we're shifting office space that was designed to be really efficient to spaces that are designed to be effective and high-performing for people, which means that they really need to be user-centric for the people that are going to spend time there, that it's balanced for that focus and collaboration and that are experience-rich. In other words, we've got to create places where people really want to be and enable them to do their best work.
Doesn't the research also show, though, that open offices increase stress and illness? And, you know, we heard Elaine talking about, you know, wanting to be away from someone who has a cold, but also, you know, can reduce concentration and productivity as well.
I think noise and distraction is certainly an issue. And in our research, when we're looking at both private office environments as well as open plan, noise and distraction is still an issue. In terms of well-being, we're seeing some mixed results. That actually, when walls do come down, daylight and view is supported for everyone. That does quite a lot for helping with mitigating stress and actually helping. There's health benefits as well. Creating interconnecting stairs that people are actually moving around the office, not just sitting at their desks all the time, also has a number of health benefits. So part of it is creating the opportunity for choice, variety, and control. And when you have control over your work environment, that really brings down the stress environment. So if your stress levels. So if you've got colleagues that are talking and you have the ability to pick up and move, or ask them to pick up and go to a meeting space so that you can continue to focus, that really does have helps with the stress level.
And again, Janet Pogue McLaurin is Global Workplace Leader with Gensler. We also have Nikhil Saval with us, who is with N+1 magazine, editor of N+1, and author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. And Nikhil, let me go to you on let's talk about the research a bit more, because there was a Harvard Business School study that said that there's less ability to communicate well when you don't have walls or doors.
That's right. I mean, that sort of research, it's interesting because I feel like studies of this kind come out with some regularity and have been for several years. If you go back to the history of the open office plan, that's always been the case. I mean, we mentioned earlier the German concept for the open office that came out of the late 50s, early 60s. And this was, meant to be egalitarian and meant to kind of improve communication in a workspace. And it makes sense in a way. I mean, there's nothing necessarily intuitive about having closed-door offices in a periphery and desks in the center, which is how most American offices were. But it was widely rejected by workers who had sort of unions or forms of co-management in Western and Northern Europe because of all the complaints that we have today, which is concentration, noise, distraction, things like that. And so it was widely rejected, and what people opted for the most part was closed-door offices, which don't really necessarily mitigate against collaboration and all the sort of things that people supposedly need to work. The other thing is that, collaboration is like this buzzword. Office design is full of buzzwords. But in fact, concentration and sort of focus and private work turns out to be quite a lot of work that needs to get done. And so, I think there's a kind of image that's associated with openness that doesn't always correspond to people's actual work experience.
Especially if it's more disruptive or noisy. I got a comment here from a listener, Jenny. I just want to read it and get your response, Nikhil. She says, I detest the open floor plan. Even cubicles were so much better. Right now I'm standing at my desk with my earbuds in while 5 feet away from me, three people are having a long discussion in an open area. The discussion has nothing to do with anything that affects my job.
Yeah, I mean, I totally hear that. It's a very common complaint. I think the thing is, we have to, it is certainly cheaper in many instances to have a kind of pure open plan, but this is also about power. I mean, like, if we go back to the example of workers rejecting open office plans in other countries, the United States is uniquely brutal as a developed country that has in the way it treats its workers and what kind of control they have over their work. And the design of a workplace is, in fact, an instantiation of that. They have very little control over how it looks. And I think if more workers were listened to and if they had more systems in order to exert their demands, you would see fewer open office plans in the U.S.
Well, let me go back to you, Elaine Moore, because a key issue that has to do with all of this is, I think, how workers feel, how productive they are, how much they can focus, and so forth. That gets into the whole nature of the debate here. And Now they're talking about an era of deskless offices, which is upon us next somehow, and I don't know what that's going to mean.
Supposedly about half of U.S. or half of multinational companies anyway are going to have hot desking by 2020. I think it's really interesting that in both cases, these are two trends in open plan offices and hot desking.
You want to talk about what hot desking is exactly?
Hot desking is where you don't have your own workstation. So when you come in the morning, there'll be a bank of desks and you just need to grab the first one that you
carry a bag over your shoulder because workplace can change and you got to wipe it off and give
take
it up.
Take your laptop with you. You don't put up pictures of your family, your pets, or your plants. You take everything with you. You have a locker maybe for your sort of valuables. That's about it. And in both cases, workers.
This is the Roma people approach to employment or something.
It's movable, exactly. I think it sends out quite a bad message that low-level workers are fairly disposable, that their workplace is not stable, that they are required to keep moving, keep all their stuff on them like a pack horse. But saying that, I don't know. I like working in coffee shops. I sometimes think, is it just the same as going into your local Starbucks and setting up your laptop? And that's, I can do that and that's fine. But for some reason, hot desking feels different and is something that I'd like having my own desk and my own space and leaving my papers everywhere.
Now, let me read another tweet and I'll go to you on this, Janet Pogue McLaurin. Jeff writes or tweets, I worked in one, that is an open office, for 15 years and was continually interrupted every day. Working at home for the past year, I'm amazed at how productive I can be. Stupid idea. Janet?
So I'll confess that I love working at home to get caught up occasionally as well. And so part of it is, how do you provide variety and choice at the office when you need to be at the office that would allow you to go to an enclosed focus room, for example, and do that very thing that you can do at home, but still be accessible to collaborate when needed. And I think, you know, Elaine was just talking about the idea of hot desking. And I do think there's certain functions within an organization that might be appropriate for. It's like the sales team that's always traveling, that is only in the office on occasion. And the reason they come to the office is more to collaborate than it may be to sit down and focus and catch up on expense reports, because they did that while they were traveling. But we run into the danger when we try to apply one solution to an entire organization trying to cover all the functions. And so if we were to provide a variety of spaces that allow different people to actually have some autonomy and choice, that goes a long way toward, providing an environment that works for all. And that includes introverts, extroverts, those that are mobile versus those that need to be at the office every day. And so by providing that variety, it really does go toward in an egalitarian type of work environment.
Well, since you mentioned introverts, I'm going to read a comment from a listener named Victoria who says they're bad for introverts. She says, speaking as a former HR director, boy, do I have thoughts. It's no secret that U.S. culture values extroversion. Workplaces, especially open plans, are incredibly challenging for people who need to formulate thoughts, who need space to regroup, who are excellent workers but just work differently. And I wonder if I could get you to weigh in on this again, Nikhil Saval. I mean, especially when we're talking about what gets me is the sense of how suddenly, well, Siri and Alexa and maybe Google are running, those voices are running through our heads in these open offices to the degree that it seems to go against, well, real human interaction, human communication.
Yeah, that sort of speaks to the way that we think about technology, I think, in workplaces. I think there is a kind of progressive or Whiggish narrative, you might call it, about technology, which is to suggest that, one, that technology, these new interfaces, these new forms of kind of communicating are necessarily progressive, and one, that they're necessarily choices or things that we consent to. And in fact, it's not necessarily the case. I think if you were to collectively organize society and ask whether they wanted to decide whether they could have these phones in their pockets, even essentially computers that tracked all of your movements and everything you said and made you constantly available to work at any given hour, probably people would collectively say no. But in fact, we just ended up with this situation for various reasons. So I think similarly, when it comes to workplace design, you know, I think there's, you know, I think it's quite right that there's a role for things like hot desking or for, you know, for things where you don't have a permanent desk or you have a space where you just come in from out of town, et cetera. But the notion that this would become a kind of dominant paradigm is speaks to the same way that we kind of treat technology in all aspects of our lives, that it is somehow always going to augment or enable things that we want to do. Similarly, getting rid of all kind of ambient evidence of your existence at your desk or your family life or what have you. Also, it just seems, you know, it seems to accept the notion that your computer or your phone or what have you will actually be the best way to do your work, but actually just getting rid of paper, getting rid of all sort of evidence of just tangible, you know, ways that we used to work in the past, files, things like that, it's not always going to work and it's not always going to be successful. And I think that's just the domination of tech monopolies over our lives, essentially, in creeping into our workplaces.
But open spaces are cheaper. I come back to that major point. And let's hear from you, our listeners, on this. In fact, let me invite you to join us. We're talking about open floor plans, and if you have one, and if you have an office open, or some self-interest in this, KQED is changing its office plan, but you may want to join us and let us know how you feel about it, and maybe bring some tips forward about those of you who are struggling to work in one. We'd certainly like to hear your thoughts and like to hear what your impressions have been and what you can bring to the table here in terms of bringing more light to this subject. We welcome your calls, and let me tell you how you can join us right now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You can also, of course, go to our Facebook page, but we do want to hear from you and want your involvement. And Elaine, let me go back to you as we come up on the break here. Tools for workers to keep focused.
Yeah, the startup community has got all sorts of ideas for ways to combat some of the problems in open plan offices. And I would strongly encourage you to have a look at some of these online, because it's like a dystopia out there. So there was one I found, I think the startup is called Hush Me. And the idea is that you put this mechanism over your face, over your mouth, so you can talk on a phone and you won't be heard by the rest of the office. You look like Bane from Batman. It looks insane. There's another idea from Panasonic. They had these human blinkers. So the idea is you wrap this fabric around your head and you won't be distracted by all the people around you. The idea that we have to put voice boxes on and human blinkers in order to combat the the open plan office problems, I think
technology,
that means that there should be a different
with
idea.
What technology hath wrought,
yeah.
More technology.
Yeah.
Let me read a comment from Wendy, who is a nursing mom, and says, when I went back to work after my son was born, I was put in an open cubicle. As a nursing mother, though, I needed a private space several times a day, and the only space was the ladies' restroom. Pumping in that space was, to put it mildly, unacceptable. The company moved me to the next private office that opened up. Well, we'll hear more of your thoughts and your impressions and, well, your experiences. Again, we're talking to Elaine Moore, deputy editor of the Lex column with the Financial Times, Janet Pogue-McLaurin, who is global workplace leader with Gensler, and Nicole Saval, who is editor of N Plus magazine and author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Our listeners, speak up and speak out. When we return, you're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about open office plans and, well, big question, why workers seem to hate them and why people keep building them. And here's a listener, Denise, who says, open plans are cheaper than cubicles. That's the only reason for these changes. All the other crap about fostering collaboration, et cetera, is just words you can't say on the air. That starts with bull. Well, we have Elaine Moore with us from the Financial Times and Janet Pogue-McLaurin from Gensler and Nikhil Saval from N Plus Magazine, and we have you, our listeners. Let's go to our callers, and let's go first to Oakland and welcome you. Dave, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on. Ironically, I'm stuck in traffic on the Bay Bridge right now.
Sorry.
I am a transportation consultant. Excuse me. I've worked all over the valley and the region, and I think I agree with a lot of the comments. The dirty little secret about this is that you can get about 30% more people in the same square footage. And that has serious consequences for our infrastructure and our transportation in particular. And I'd encourage any company that's thinking of moving to an open office plan to consider transportation. And if I could get a plug in here, my firm Commute Source can help people out with that.
Well, let's talk about that. Jenna Polk McLaurin, let me go to you on this. Packing people in and transportation, some comments from you?
Sure. You know, I think when open plan goes awry, it's when they try to pack too many people in. You know, the companies that shift just to save money using open plan often fail. It's not about necessarily trying to get a denser, you know, more people per square foot. It's trying to get the right mix of work settings. That said, you know, we've talked about open offices are cheaper, and we're not finding that to necessarily be the truth. The initial build-out costs may be slightly less expensive due to construction, but by the time you add in furniture, maintenance, and operating costs, it may actually be a little bit higher due to the higher use of common areas like enclosed focus groups and meeting rooms and work cafes and all the other work settings you need to supplement the open plan to make it actually work. So if it's just to pack more people in, that's the wrong approach.
Can I get you to comment, Nicole Saval?
I think that it's essentially, you know, it's certainly the wrong approach to pack more people in. I just have very little confidence that most companies have their employees' well-being in mind. I think that it's essentially an issue of who has control over these decisions. And I think, you know, what one place to start is sort of thinking about what a workplace design would look like if more employees were involved in the construction and thinking around the design. You know, it was mentioned earlier in the program that actually a lot of workplace design ends up looking very similar, even in the most sort of innovative, rich companies in Silicon Valley. And so, you know, what it strikes me that there's a kind of paucity of ideas and a kind of groupthink that's going on that is producing this sameness of effect across workspaces. I, too, have toured tons of offices.
Wait a minute. This is supposed to create more innovation and creativity, but not necessarily along the line you're talking about. Huh?
No, I mean, you end up with this situation where it's you know, I think there's a kind of, there is a certain kind of hegemony or just domination of a particular workplace idea. You know, and just to be clear, I mean, when we talk about the shrinkage of work space per employee, that has been going on certainly in the United States for many years. The cubicle was part of that, actually. The cubicle was in its own way a way to cram more and more people into less and less space into these little boxes. And so we shouldn't exaggerate the differences, I think, between cubicle spaces and open plan offices. I mean, I think they're all open to a degree, and they're all sort of ways of exhibiting how little corporate America cares about its workers. And so I think that's sort of what you see in evidence, you know, even in some of these sort of more expensive or fancier work environments.
Well, let me bring more of our callers aboard here, and we go to you next. Dave, join us. Welcome.
Hi. I'm an architect in San Francisco, and here's a bit of a retail fantasy I have. Since office space for someone like me is more or less unaffordable, I'd say a decent office for an architect would be roughly $3,000 a month, sadly. And it's really not that affordable for a small-time architect. And I think I do often go to La Boulange with my developer clients, and it's actually a very pleasant place to meet. And I'm actually thinking that there might be some, it might happen from Starbucks, La Boulange, who knows, but it's got to be some kind of combination of WeWork and a coffee shop. And I'd welcome some comments on that, because I think the rents are so high that no one really can afford much unless you are Gensler.
It's an important point, Dave. Thank you for it. Elaine, let me go to you and ask Elaine Moore.
Yeah, I think this was meant to be WeWork's entire reason for being at the beginning, was to provide space for individuals, for entrepreneurs or for freelancers, so that they could rent fairly cheaply. And I suppose that as the company's grown, perhaps those costs have gone up and that's no longer possible. I think also it's an interesting point to raise how expensive it is in San Francisco to rent office space. And it strikes me as...
To rent anything. A broom closet.
But it strikes me as interesting that we're still all going into offices or going into expensive cities. The development of technology, in some ways, it should free us all up to work from anywhere. We could be in a farm or Montana, or we could be in... I could be back in London and still taking part in all of this. But somehow we don't. We all come into cities, we all commute, we get stuck on the Bay Bridge, we go to expensive offices. I don't know. Somehow technology hasn't come up yet with an answer to that.
Well, Starbucks is one possibility, as the caller just said. And here, you were talking before about headphones, Elaine Moore. Marsha writes, my husband doesn't like his open office situation, and his current employer found so many people complaining that they issue every employee noise-canceling headphones. And here's Vladimir, says, hot desking? What's next? Bring your own chairs to work? Well, we've got a couple of callers here who want to weigh in on hot desking. So let's hear first from you, Danielle. You like them, huh?
Yeah, I actually work in a call center, and, you know, there's 200-plus employees. We all have the flexibility to work from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. And so with the hot desking, it really allows us, if we want to pick up extra hours, we just move desks because someone else has been assigned to our desk for a shift or what have you. It was... a little bit difficult to get used to at first because I did come from a corporate world where I had my own desk and stapler and pen, and I had to buy a little desk organizer, and I just personalized that, put my stapler, my pens, my pictures on that, and then anytime I have to move, I just bring my desk organizer with me. So I understand definitely, you know, if you have 200 employees, you never know what their shifts are going to be or what holidays look like. We have 125 desks, and people just come and go throughout the day.
Well, there's Danielle speaking up for the hot desk idea from her own experience, and I thank you for that call, Danielle. Let's hear from somebody who's not so hot about hot desks. That's you, Gavin, from Sacramento. Good morning.
Hi. I work in a place that it's two different places, and we all have hot desks and an open office space. And me and a bunch of my coworkers really struggle with being able to concentrate. And I have ADHD, so I kind of go in and wear my headphones. But I also really understand where the employer is coming from, because it's really difficult for them to stay competitive if they're not, you know, cutting costs like that, because you just can't afford a traditional office space anymore and be competitive in a lot of fields. But I find that me and a lot of my coworkers end up spending the time that we're required to there, and then going home and doing our work in our own space where we can actually concentrate.
Well, thank you for weighing in here, Gavin. Appreciate hearing from you. And let's just go to more of our callers. Let's hear next what Howard has to say. Howard, join us.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me. I teach management skills and time management. And look, the open office space is here to stay. I think what people need to do is find, and I always say, start with 15 minutes and unplug. And if you have to go to a conference room, as you said, a Starbucks, or put on headphones. But I think we get so easily distracted, and if you start taking 15 to 30 minutes every day, develop that habit, it'll help. Because I don't think you can't change your environment if that's where you are.
That's generally good advice, I think. Sort of settle down and ruminate and focus. And thank you. But we keep hearing, and let me go back to you, Janet Pogue McLaurin, it's harder to focus in an open space with an open desk plan. Open office plan, excuse me. Yeah.
Because we spend, you know, we've been measuring behaviors for a long, long time now, and we discovered that people still spend about half their day in focus. And the balance of that is virtual collaboration and face-to-face collaboration, learning, and socializing. But focus takes up a lot of our time. And sometimes that's intense focus where you really do need to go to,
an enclosed space or away from your team, sometimes just unplugging and or physically untethering yourself from your team and going and sitting and kind of hiding in plain sight on another floor or another area can really do quite a lot to getting rid of distractions and being able to focus on the task at hand.
There's also another key issue in this whole picture that we haven't broached yet, and let me go to you on this, Nikki Sval. And that is change. I mean, a lot of people suddenly are presented with a different office plan and needs a lot of adjustment, accommodation, all those kinds of things, no?
That's true. I mean, I think that you know, there is some extent to which this is, can be conceived of as generational. There are certain ways in which, some people are more, for example, with technology in the workplace, you have people who are more used to them or more early adopters who can deal with that sort of change more readily. But, you know, I think that change is itself a kind of euphemism for what's going on. I mean, I think, again, we should really stress the deep continuity here between what's been going on in previous office environments and what's happened now. I mean, we speak about the open office plan as if it were a kind of novel invention, but it has deep roots in American offices. I mean, anyone who's watched the show Mad Men or, seen The Apartment or whatever, those are open. There are these plans. There are places where people are just marooned in seas of desks and they're typists or accountants or what have you. And, the same sort of contempt for, office workers is expressed in those environments as expressed in contemporary environments. So I think that we shouldn't exaggerate the extent to which the open office plan is at all a kind of revolutionary or interesting or novel development. It's old and it's had the same sort of basic ideas behind it for decades. I mean, some of them egalitarian and what have you, but ultimately they've only sort of masked the deeper inequalities that are developed in contemporary workplaces. They haven't helped them.
I want to bring another caller on, and that's Rob. Rob, you're on. Morning.
Thank you. Comment and question. The comment is that this seems like a person with ADHD's worst nightmare. It's like a factory floor. And the question is, has this been studied in other countries, like, say, Japan or other cultures where, the business philosophy might be different, how it works over there?
Can you help us on this, Aline Moore?
I know that there's been a lot of studies in the UK, and in the UK the answers are pretty much the same. Same in Europe. I don't know about Japan. I think that's a really interesting point. If you have a workplace in which people are encouraged to think about their teams and their company in a different way, in a less individualistic way, perhaps the open plan office is more palatable. It's a really interesting point.
Any thoughts from you on this, or shed any light on it, Janet Pogue-McLaurin?
Yes, we've been actually studying this in a wide array of countries, including the U.S., Asia. We just completed one in Germany. And in Germany in particular, which was, the birthplace of Open Plan, we actually have found that it's very prevalent to have shared offices. And we actually found that those were even less effective than Open Plan here in the United States, which is an interesting finding. So we have found that as we've been studying, looking at this globally, that Open Plan can be just as effective as a private office if you really solve for some key criteria. And so if you're able to focus on, what really matters most, any space can be equally effective.
I want to read some comments that are coming in. I asked listeners' feelings about living with an open office, and Jay writes, I spent most of my life trying to work in open offices. I ended up spending hours completing my work after everyone else left or went home without pay. And Jennifer says, I've worked in tech for many years. Offices became cubicles, then they became smaller cubicles, then open floor plans. That's when I decided working from home was the full-time solution for me. And Kat says, how does one deal, or asks, how does one deal with the social discomfort of a coworker that makes very unpleasant noises all day long? Some thoughts from you, Elaine Moore?
I mean, headphones, I guess, is the only answer.
The Bose.
The head-canceling headphones. Yeah, people with colds, my entire office is down with a cold right now. It's tricky. But then I don't like working from home. I like being around my colleagues. I just wish that there was a better way to have a mixture of talking to them and seeing them and interacting and then having some quiet time and some space.
And again, Elaine Moore is deputy editor of the Lex column with the Financial Times. And our next caller is Alexis. Good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I feel the shrinking of the workspace is kind of a metaphor for the shrinking of the value of the American employee and maybe global employee, probably more likely. I also think that with the kind of astronomical profits and valuations of these companies, I think you said WeWork is at $50 billion. I think Apple exceeded $1 trillion. I don't know what Microsoft. But it's almost like in proportion to how much money they're making and being valued at versus how they're cutting employees. And it seems to me the architecture is kind of in the direction of creating contract work, that you've got these kind of 15-minute, you know, cycles that workers do, like someone said, in a factory. And I don't even understand how workers would be evaluated. There are people just constantly clocking in and clocking out. There's so many questions, but it just seems like it's devaluing the person, the individual, the space people need to be both social and have regroup time or thinking time. And, you know, just be evaluated as a human being rather than someone who can get to their speed desk on time.
Alexis,
for 10 minutes.
Alexis, raising, I think, a couple of very important points. I'd like to go to you on this, Nikhil Saval. I mean, globalization has played an immense role in this whole picture that we're talking about, but also this idea of contract work.
Yeah, I think that was a very brilliant point that the caller made. I mean, one regarding the kind of relationship between architecture and power in the workplace. And contract work is interesting. I mean, it's one of these things that's very hard to study and to discern, and there have been a lot of claims about its increase, freelancing increasing in general in the workplace. And then the kind of statistics have been equivocal about this. I think the Bureau of the Labor Statistics recently did a study, and the increase was not quite as great, if I recall correctly, as was thought to be. That said, there is a kind of creeping, I would say, of a kind of self-employed mindset into workers in American companies in particular, but probably in I'm sure that's true in other countries as well, where it's there are ways in which you are constantly sort of expected to act as if you were a contract worker, and your job protections in the U.S. are very minimal. I mean, to an extent, companies can determine when you go to the bathroom and when you don't. I mean, that does happen in Amazon warehouses, and that's technically possible with white-collar workplaces as well. So there are ways in which you kind of are, you're the distinction between a contract worker and a salaried worker is essentially, benefits and the stability of a paycheck, but there are other ways in which the resemblances are very strong, and the fact that you can be severed at any minute, it makes it, makes it quite scary in a way to be an American worker in an office.
Again, Nikhil Saval is editor of N+1 magazine and author of Cube, The Secret History of the Workplace. Let me go to more of your calls. Let me thank Alexis for that call and go next to Sarah. Sarah, join us. Welcome.
Yes. Hi. I was part of a focus group at UC Berkeley, and it was mostly students between ages 18 and maybe recent alums until 35. So this may be a generational thing, but they had us all design our own offices. They didn't tell us anything about cost or any parameters, and most of us had designed something that had an open office format, but some people had, certain concerns, like, well, we wanted the supervisors behind closed doors because we don't want them, like, spying on us or looking at us all the time. Or we had, there was like a Chinese international student in my group who said, well, we want the important clients to come through a secret corridor. We don't want everyone to see who's coming and going and having these important meetings. But, or someone like me who has chronic back pain said, well, I don't mind an open office or having a hot desk as long as it's a standing desk that's ergonomic. So if you just put people and have them design something, most likely there's going to be an open office format with some room for privacy when needed. But also it is a generational thing. I think younger people are already used to working at libraries and, you know, in a student environment where you don't have that much privacy to begin with.
Yeah, they're more conditioned, probably, the millennials. Sarah, thank you for that call. Good to hear from you. And here's Marina, who writes, after 15-plus years in closed offices, I'm at a new company and really enjoy the open office plan. It's easy to find anyone I need to talk to, and I've made good relationships with people from other departments. All of us spend a good amount of time working on project teams. We have small privacy rooms for personal phone calls or conference calls. I vote yes for open offices, and I'm a lifelong ADD-type person to boot. And just a quick reminder that we are talking about open office plans, and we're talking with Elaine Moore, Janet Pogue McLaurin, and Nikhil Saval. And we'll go to more of your calls forthwith here. I want to read a comment from Christopher, though. It says, in the 1940s, an entrepreneur named Carl F. Braun did a study on his draftspeople, and by moving them from open offices to private offices, their productivity went up by 35%. He estimated the increased cost by 2 to 3% of the total cost of an employee. So we're getting some really positive things about open offices here. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller, and that's you, Deborah. Thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi. I just wanted to mention the type of employee that is an administrative assistant, where you're not working on necessarily your own project, but you're constantly being interrupted and helping others, or maybe trying to focus on organizing 10 expense reports or something. You can't really wear headphones. You're always on the phone. Just wondered if somebody wanted to comment about that.
A comment, Elaine Moore?
Well, I think that's true. There are certainly some jobs where it would be very difficult to be in a private office, but equally you are at the mercy of all the worst aspects of an open plan office. And I think an admin assistant is one of those jobs, especially. I think it's really hard to know what the answer is. I'm really fascinated by this idea that the students at Stanford, when given free rein to design an office, all came up with open plan offices. We don't seem to have any alternatives.
A lot of them are in the tech pipeline.
Maybe we're just all used to it now and we can't imagine anything different.
Well, let me thank the caller and go to another caller. And that's you, Hakeem. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to make a comment about the original hot desk open office space, which would be something that Sarah mentioned just 2 calls ago, to the library. I think college students grow up into a system where for 4 years they're used to studying in this open floor plan, but every single day they're vying for the limited private study rooms that are available. So much so to the point where at my alma mater, UC Santa Barbara, they have an online booking system for these private study rooms. And I'm interested in what Janet would have to say, coming from a professional background in architecture. How do college students transition into the workplace, and how do their sentiments change once they're working in a corporate environment? Do they still have that same propensity towards a private workspace, even when there's ample open floor plan available?
Good question, Hakeem. Thank you for it. Janet Pogue McLaurin.
Yeah, it's a great question, because we've been studying how students are learning at the university level, and they're used to having a lot of different variety and choice around where they're studying, how they're going to meet with teams, you know, with classrooms. They use the entire university as their workspace. And we're seeing that carry over into the professional work environment, that they really value having a multitude of spaces and the technology to go with it. And we just completed another study that we haven't released yet, but we found that, once again, back to a previous caller's kind of hypothesis, that most employees do want that open collaborative workspace. But we are seeing some slight nuances between generations and even men versus women on exactly what that looks like in practice. So we're seeing that, you know, the new grads want twice as much value building social connections and community than the other generations. But they, all three generations, kind of Gen Z up through boomers, believe that promoting team building and collaboration was the number one kind of value of what they want in that
open plan.
Let me dovetail on that for a moment, Janet, because a lot of listeners want to know about the effect on school and education. I'm looking at a question from a listener. It says, you know whether divided school classrooms, which are open plan workspaces, are better for students? Yeah, I'm going back to you on this, Janet, if you have some thoughts on it. Although Elaine, I think, wanted to weigh in, too.
All I was going to say was just that there are rules in libraries and there are rules in school classrooms, which mean that students have to be quiet in them. And that's the big difference between those spaces and workplaces. In workplaces, you cannot instruct all of your, well, perhaps you can, but I've never been worked in one. You can't instruct all of your workers to be in absolute silence throughout the whole day. If you could, perhaps it would be different, but you can't.
And Janet Pogue McLaurin?
Although I do think that that's part of the change management that we're seeing in workplaces today, that there are quiet zones, there's text-free zones with some organizations, and it almost has those library rules around it so that it does provide that choice and autonomy that people really want, because the best spaces are really designed with people in mind and with those people's voices that are actually going to use the space as a part of the design process.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but a final question, maybe Nikhil Savala, that you could give us a quick answer to. Alicia wants to know, why do open offices keep getting built? Because the CEOs don't work in them.
It actually came up earlier. A lot of CEOs do sort of work in them, I think it's a big fallacy. I mean, you have Mark Zuckerberg working in Facebook.
That's more the exception, though. I think it's safe to say, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting in the sense that Mike Bloomberg, and this is more like worked in, you know. But the issue is that they do travel in a private jet around the world and make millions of dollars a year, unlike most employees. So we just have to emphasize that the egalitarianism of these open plan offices is completely spurious.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. We're really literally out of time. But thank you, Nikhil Savala, and thank you, Janet Pogue McLaurin, and thank you, Elaine Moore, and thank you, our listeners, for participating in this hour. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can continue the discussion by going online at kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.